talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the Library of Alexandria, and we'll be finding out how it became the ancient world's greatest repository of knowledge. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. The Library of Alexandria, established in the 3rd century BCE in Egypt, was the ancient world's greatest repository of knowledge. Designed to house all human knowledge, it boasted hundreds of thousands of scrolls, including works on philosophy, science, and literature. Scholars from across the Mediterranean gathered at the library to study and exchange ideas. Although its exact destruction date is unclear, the library suffered multiple fires before finally declining during the Roman Empire, leaving a legacy of intellectual pursuit that still resonates today. And to help me explore the library, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Vilika Vendrick is Research Professor Emerita of Egyptian Archaeology and Digital Humanities at UCLA, also currently Professor at the Polytechnic University in Turin. And her books include Egyptian Archaeology and The Archaeology of Mobility, Nomads in the Old and in the New World. Dr. Cynthia Johnston is Senior Lecturer in the History of the Book at the Institute of English Studies at the School of Advanced Study at the University of London. And she's the editor of Cambridge University Press's Elements series on book collecting. Professor Islam Issa is a multi-award-winning author, broadcaster and curator, and is Professor of Literature and History at Birmingham City University. And his books include Alexandria, The City That Changed the World. Well, you are all very welcome. And Islam, we might begin with you and the creation of Alexandria first as a city before we get to the library. And you describe it as a city drawn in sand, inspired by the tales of Homer and his own ambitions of empire.
Well, thank you. I mean, when we think about Alexandria, as with the library, we do also think about mythology. You know, the founding myth of Alexandria is important to Alexandrians, and it's important to the story of the library as well. So I guess that's a kind of caveat that we are surrounded by this mythology. But yes, Alexander is taught, as is Ptolemy, his successor, who really creates much of Alexandria. They're taught by Aristotle, who seems to have instilled in Alexander, according to the legends, a love of Homer. And legend has it, Alexander, in his sleep, sees a venerable figure who tells him about this island where loud the billows roar. And it's the island of Pharos, which is part of the Greek imagination. And Alexander, according to Plutarch, gets up immediately and ventures to this island off the Mediterranean. It's probably something of an anticlimax. It's a rather barren island, some fishing villages on the Mediterranean coast. But he sees the potential of this particular location. It's at the intersection of the continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And legend has it that he gets down onto his knees and begins to draw a city into the sand. And that city includes the usual things, the squares, the roads, the markets. But it also includes a shrine to the muses, which is what will become the library. So that's a really important founding myth that the Alexandrians very much believe, and that forms much of the history that follows.
And in a way, you see kind of two things coming together with the building of Alexandria. It's making it an economic capital, and then it's also, as you show, a way of wielding soft power by the way knowledge is gathered and disseminated.
I do think that there are two very radical ideas in the founding of Alexandria. The first is Alexander's idea that if you harmonize, and I think he might have been expected to Hellenize, bring the Greek culture the Macedonian culture into the new space. But if you harmonize, if you bring different people from different parts of the world to work together, that you will create some economic prosperity. So he invites, for example, the Jews who come in numbers because they'll have freedom of worship and initially no or little taxation. People from the Levant, people from further south, people from around the region, even as far as India, come to Alexandria in the first few decades. And so by allowing them to worship as they want, by allowing them to find jobs, that brings about some economic prosperity, and it works to a large extent because it becomes possibly the busiest harbour in the region and an economic hub. So that's the first radical idea. I think the second one is directly linked to the library. And I think it's part of the Ptolemaic vision just after Alexander, which is that if you are able to gather and look after and disseminate knowledge, then you have a very sure and certain soft power in the region. And I think both of those ideas worked. The idea that you can bring about economic prosperity by bringing people from different parts of the world to a trade hub, and the idea that knowledge equals power.
Cynthia, it's a remarkable story, and it's also one that continues to inspire people. People love the idea of a lost library, and especially when it was meant to be the storehouse for the sum of all of human knowledge. And it has that mythical dimension to it, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think we all had sort of a terrible sense of almost deja vu with the digital attack on the British Library recently, where certainly users that are relying on remote access to the library were really abandoned and cast adrift by the cyber attack. So it's not only sort of a mythical idea, but it's sort of an idea that's still with us and very much alive and kicking.
Do you think there are lessons that we can take from the destruction of the library at Alexandria and apply it to our own libraries today? Because as you say, you have these cyber attacks now, and it shows the importance of, I suppose, backing up information and diversifying holdings, because so much of it now is digitized in terms of newspaper collections and various historical collections. And, you know, we think that they can be in the cloud and invulnerable, but they're also susceptible to different types of attack, and they can also be destroyed.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We are very vulnerable, I think. Absolutely. I think we're in a perilous state.
Yeah, Islam, do you think there are safeguards that we should put in place in a way because of these new modern attacks, but also lessons that we can learn from what happened at Alexandria?
I think much of what we get from Alexandria is related to funding, oddly enough, because it's a state endeavour. So we know from the second century letter of Aristeas that the ambition was to collect every book in the world. And it's stated, you know, they furnished the library with much money in order to do so. So there's something here that the decline of the library, I don't think it was, you know, destroyed in one go. The decline of the library is largely to do with priorities of the state. So, for example, the chief librarian was was kind of like a minister picked by the ruler, the king. He'd also have a direct link to the king, a direct line. Stayed in the royal quarter, has to double as the tutor for the prince and princess. And these librarians were initially sort of celebrities and paid huge amounts so they don't take bribes and so on. We come to later times in Alexandria, you know, as it declines, and by which I mean, you know, just a couple of centuries later, and the chief librarian becomes somebody from the military. Somebody who has no credentials for that, because it's become a kind of, the priorities have changed, the priorities in terms of funding, the priorities in terms of what the library does and what the chief librarian is supposed to be doing. So I think a big takeaway from this, is the idea that you need commitment and funding in order for libraries to exist. And in many ways, the Alexandria example is often presents us with this kind of microcosm for the priorities of the leaders at that period. You can see that in whether the library is doing well or doing badly.
Filike, there is very interesting archaeological evidence and some very significant expeditions, including a very famous Polish expedition that went there. How much can we reconstruct from the archaeological evidence?
Well, actually, almost nothing. There is indeed a Polish expedition that has been working in the center of Alexandria for over 20 years. And archaeology in Alexandria is extremely difficult because it's a built-up city. And imagine one building is going to be replaced by another building. Archaeologists come in, do research in a tiny, tiny little window in this ancient city and try to extrapolate what the entire city looked like. So the same way that there's a lot of myth around the founding of Alexandria, the founding of the library, there's also a lot of myth connected to what this library actually looked like, where it was exactly, how it related to other parts of the city, because we know, again, from textual evidence, that it was in the royal quarter of Alexandria. This royal quarter took up around maybe a fourth or even a third of the city. But there was also a library connected to the Temple of Serapis outside the royal quarter. So there were actually different places that were important for as keepers of the knowledge of Ptolemaic Egypt. And we need to think about this library as a holder of knowledge, yes, linked to philosophy, yes, but also from the Egyptian tradition, the idea that a temple and a priest are part of the library is extremely important as well. And in a way, we see that continuing in the Middle Ages, in the monasteries being the center of learning in the Christian world. Now, as for the Polish expedition, they excavated in the center of Alexandria and they found about 22 lectural halls. But this was from a much later period. This was around 7 centuries later. It does show that there was an ongoing tradition in Alexandria of being a city and a center of learning, being a great place where philosophy, where scholarship blossomed. So Islam was talking about the slow decay of the library. But with that, we also see that this tradition of Alexandria within the whole Mediterranean knowledge system persisted. And great danger was brought to it, actually, in the early Christian period, when there was a pushback against this free thinking and free debating of knowledge. So it's really at the center of very, very interesting scholastic and philosophical movements that's reflected in the archaeology of the later period. But from the actual library, we have no trace.
Islam, do you think the library actually was as impressive as the mythology suggests? Was it really this home for all of these incredible scrolls and parchments and this collection of the sum of human knowledge at that point? Or is there a sense that perhaps it has been mythologized and romanticized with the passing of time?
I do think it would have been impressive in the sense that so many of the scholars of the period were gravitating towards it. There were incentives for scholars to go there. You know, they had free lodging and were paid a stipend and so on. And it's this museum, you know, that's adjacent to the library that would have had much of that scholarly activity. But I think we do have at least textual evidence of much translation taking place. of a kind of diversity of texts being there, you know, including Egyptian texts and Zoroastrian texts and so on. It wasn't in Jewish texts. It wasn't just the Greek texts. I think that there's something to be said about the kinds of policies that were put in place as well by the Ptolemies to ensure that it was the leading library. We've just heard about all these sister libraries as well, and I think that's very true as well, that Alexandria would have had would have been a bit of a college town in many ways, with lots of little libraries as the books increased, because you know there are reports that there's hundreds of thousands of books and eventually that they don't fit into the main library.
And what do you think was the vision for the library for the early Ptolemies and for those involved in its creation?
I think there was primarily this idea of soft power, collecting knowledge in order to gain that soft power. There is some suggestion that this was supposed to integrate the different populations. So we know this translation of, for example, the Hebrew Bible basically said to the Jewish population, you've no excuse but to integrate into this kind of new Alexandrian society. So I think that that's part of the vision. Another part of the vision is very much to create knowledge as well, because if you create knowledge, you can manipulate it to your own political ends. And some of the skeptics of the period, there was a skeptical poet who wrote that the scholars weren't in the shrine of muses, but the cage of muses, that they were basically completing the tasks that the Ptolemaic dynasty required of them and supporting that dynasty. I think there's lots of different aspects to it, but primarily this kind of influence over the world and attracting people to the city, and we see that, for example, in the embargo of papyrus. So that other libraries can't compete. The papyrus is embargoed around 190 BC because there were rival libraries, like in Pergamon.
And what was the role of the chief librarian?
The chief librarian was oversaw the whole operation. It was a kind of ministerial role, in the sense that they had a direct line with the king. They doubled as the royal tutor. So they taught the prince and princess and so on. And they really did gain this kind of celebrity status. They were important ministerial like figures, but different librarians had different priorities. So, for example, the second recorded librarian, Callimachus, was very interested in cataloguing. So he catalogued, it's said he catalogued around 120,000 literary scrolls into different categories, so comedy, epic, lyric, tragedy. He catalogued other subjects like history and law and mathematics and so on. There was even one category called miscellaneous, where you'd probably find the cookbooks and so on. So different librarians had different priorities, like cataloguing, like translation, and so on.
Well, tonight we are exploring the library at Alexandria. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about its position in Alexandria and in Egyptian culture. And we'll be finding out about the treasures within. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history and we're exploring the Library of Alexandria with a brilliant panel of experts, Professor Philika Vendrick, Research Professor Emerita at UCLA and Professor at the Polytechnic University in Turin, Dr. Cynthia Johnston of the Institute of English Studies at the School of Advanced Study at the University of London, and Professor Islam Issa, Professor of Literature and History at Birmingham City University and the author of Alexandria, The City That Changed the World. Philika, when we try to contextualise the library in terms of Alexandria itself, and I suppose in terms of that ancient world, I suppose how do we think, for example, that the physical and environmental environment influenced the design, influenced the function, influenced perhaps the intercultural exchanges that might have occurred within the library?
Alexandria as a city is really interesting, and the place of the library within it, of course. Because the Ptolemies, yes, they were kings of Egypt, but their whole perspective was the Mediterranean. And there were a lot of Ptolemaic settlements all around the eastern Mediterranean coast. So there was this real drive to make Alexandria the pearl of the Mediterranean. And the library played a very important part in that. The fact that the library was in this very special quarter, a well-protected quarter, we should think, also says how important this particular effort was. And as Islam already mentioned, Alexandria wasn't the only place where they tried to create such a center of knowledge. Pergamon was apparently in competition for the scrolls and the books to make this very important statement. And it's actually encouraging that knowledge was considered such a great good and such an important way of putting a country, a city in the foreground. Within Egypt, that's not that surprising because scholarship writing and worship always went together. All big Egyptian temples had the House of Life, which was the center of learning where the Egyptian scribes were based. And in a way, the Greek community that lived in Egypt before the founding of Alexandria was already quite used to this way of thinking. From this little bit of archaeology that we can do in Alexandria, it's clear that there were Egyptian temples active in which Greek inhabitants actually worshipped. And it's clear from the archaeology that inhabitants of Alexandria were in many ways Greeks who had already lived in Egypt for generations. The interesting thing of the position of the library is that it functioned in a very multicultural environment where it was not just Macedonian and Greek influence, but definitely also Egyptian influence and, as was mentioned before, Jewish influence. So it's an amalgam of culture that created this very, very interesting way of thinking about the world.
Islam, do you think then that in a way you can almost see it as a kind of a melting pot between all of these different cultures and sources of knowledge from Greece, from Egypt, from perhaps Persia and other cultures, and it really shows the cosmopolitan nature of the collection?
I agree. I think that there was a global quest for books. You know, the search for books was global in every sense. We have examples of some of the Ptolemies writing to their counterparts eastwards and asking them for books, if they can send them books. We have the agents that were sent out by the library to collect books went far and wide as well. So the quest for books covered and affected the entire sort of Mediterranean and Eastern economy, if you like. So that's true, and it ensured that the holdings of the library were diverse and quite inclusive. I think to some extent at the beginning, the library is intended to be a Greek language institution, and we see that from the kinds of translations. But the books originated from I think what would have been to them every known culture and every known language. So the Egyptian priests were tasked with writing about their own cultures. There was the Hebrew Bible translated, Zoroastrian texts. It does become a kind of global hub.
And do we know anything about the scholars who worked in the library? Because I've read stuff that suggests that Euclid, working in geometry, would have been involved there. People who were calculating the Earth's circumference and various philosophers and mathematicians. Was there a gathering of scholars who were really, in the current lingo, producing this cutting-edge research using the resources of the library?
Yes, they would have been invited and given accommodation, stipend, food, and that's where they would have had dining halls in which they could discuss their work, lecture halls and benches, outdoor benches and that kind of thing, so that they could really engage in a scholarly conversation. And in many ways, they did produce some fascinating research. Part of the advantage of Alexandria, actually, in comparison to Athens, is its relative lack of democracy. So Alexandria, you couldn't really be removed from the city on grounds of impiety, but that was happening in Athens. They'd vote people out of the city, you know, on oyster shells. But that wasn't the case in Alexandria. So there was, for example, when it comes to ideas about the earth being flat or not, Eratosthenes is one of the earliest to say that it's not flat. Or when it comes to heliocentrism and the arguments for and against that, you know, Claudius Ptolemy was actually against heliocentrism. You had both ideas, those who thought that the sun was the center, those who thought that the earth was the center. So you did have many different schools of thought within the Alexandrian scholarly community. But on top of that, you know, huge advances in engineering and mathematics, whether that's development of geometry, the invention of the early steam engine, calendar reforms such as the idea of leap years, and so on. And then on top of that, the advances in poetry, with, you know, one school that valued long epics and another that valued these short epigrams, and also medicine, where some of the techniques used, for example, for breast cancer are still used today, and where women were supposedly welcome into the medical school, which again wasn't the case elsewhere.
So it definitely seems to be more than just a library. It seems to be having some of the function, some of the role of a kind of a university. It seems to have elements of more of a symposium of knowledge, or a place where you have all of these people gathering, and the accommodation and the discussions and the debating, that it's not just simply going in and studying your manuscript.
It's not. And I think that's where there's a slight differentiation between what would have been the library, you know, biblio in the sense of books, and then the museum. So the shrine to books and the shrine to the muses, the museum adjacent to it, which is the kind of research center. But they kind of work together. They work in tandem. And, you know, the books are essential to that discovery. The scholars are both reading the books and writing new ones. But also because the state really wants to make sure it has a monopoly over the books, you know, they wouldn't have been allowed to take the books out of that complex. So they're kind of forced to stay in there, which increases this idea you mentioned about a space in which all of this lively conversation is and research is happening.
Cynthia, why was there such a renaissance? Why was there such a renewal and afterlife in the story of the library centuries later, in the 11th and 12th centuries, where so many new scholars suddenly looked back to this ancient library and found it something that was inspiring their own cultural renaissance?
I think that, well, those communities and actually a lot of those texts survive through the early monastic libraries, which are formed in sort of Monte Cassino, etc., through virtue of copying of text as part of the monastic duties, monastic performance, as a sort of a sacred practice. So you have these books, some books that survive from the classical world, and there are no texts, correct me if I'm wrong, that are known to have survived at all from Alexandria. We don't have any evidence for that, except what we can read about in other accounts of it. But I think one of the things that is inspiring to scholars of the 11th and 12th century Renaissance, really in scholasticism, is this collection of minds, collections of people who want to discuss ideas, sort of intellectual centers. And they begin the monastic schools in Northern Europe and in Northern France in particular. And you see from those monastic schools, you see the evolution of the first universities, the nascent universities in Italy, in France, and in Britain.
Why did that story then continue as the centuries went on, that you see it again in the 19th century, the Library of Alexandria being something that is like hugely inspirational, hugely significant for so many?
Yeah, I think that, well, you don't have sort of national libraries established in Western Europe anyway until the 18th century, and you don't have public libraries until you get to the 19th century. And in Britain, anyway, the Public Libraries Act of 1850. And I think that this idea of access to knowledge beyond the confines of private collections, beyond the confines of, say, universities or monastic collections, which had been dispersed through the Reformation, but this idea of collections of knowledge that had universal access was something that I think stayed in sort of intellectual history, and that this was, I mean, if you look at sort of the Carnegie libraries that are built, philanthropist Andrew Carnegie, I mean, there are a lot of them in Ireland, I think. I think there are about 600 of them in the UK and Ireland. And these are built in a variety of styles, Baroque and classical, etc. But a lot of them look like sort of classical buildings, sort of, the classic revival architecture. And this idea of keeping all the world's knowledge together in one place that can be accessed by anyone. I know that wasn't the case in Alexandria, but I think you could have access if you had sort of scholarly credentials. So expanding this idea of there being a place where knowledge was kept, where it could be accessed, it was tremendously exciting. And it was also, there was a romance to it as well.
And it inspired so many people then as well. And do you think that was in part the ideal of it and what it symbolized as much as anything else, that it's the thing that's lost?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not based on any real understanding in terms of archaeology or in terms of the study of the classical world. It's based on the idea of this concept of everything gathered together that can be accessed by anyone.
So Islam, when we look at the library then itself, were there particular laws or policies that were put in place as a way of advancing its mission?
There were, and most of those laws were really about acquiring books and being able to stop others from acquiring them. So, for example, any ships docking into the harbour, they were searched, not for contraband, but for books. And if a book was found on the ship, it would be taken to the library where it would be copied. And in all likelihood, the copy would go back to the owner. And those books were labelled from the ships or from the sea. So, likewise, leaving the city, you couldn't leave the city with any original books, so they'd be searched on their way out. There was an embargo on the export of papyrus, and that actually leads to, Pergamon writing on animal hides, Pergamenon, which is the origin for the word parchment. So those were among the key laws and policies that were put in place. But essentially, it creates a black market, because if you're collecting every single book, then you're hardly being selective. And so people begin to create forgeries. Or one of the common scams was to claim you'd been taught by a famous scholar or heard them speak and write a book that supposedly relays their ideas. And anonymous works began to increase. So it's not without its problems and without its issues, because what ends up happening is that books become a kind of commodity, really, a kind of currency. And the Ptolemies have to act in order to ensure that they keep the soft power that they've wielded.
Given that it was such a source of knowledge, and given that it was such an impressive place, how come we don't have an exact understanding of what happened to it. How come that wasn't properly understood, properly recounted and preserved throughout the history so that we know exactly what happened, when and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think if it was a single event, that would have been more likely the case. You know, somebody to record this single event resulted in the library's demise or burning down and so on. So I think there's ultimately a lot that's pointing towards a kind of steady decline. Yes, we do have these sister libraries. We do have these scholars and new scholars coming back and forth to Alexandria. Whenever a new group wants to philosophize, they still came to Alexandria, you know, well after the library's glory days. And we see this with, you know, philosophers in particular. But, you know, we have this first century record of from Plutarch of Julius Caesar, the fire supposedly destroying the library. But I would say that there is evidence that the library, at least written evidence, we've spoken about the archaeological evidence being very difficult. There seems to be written evidence that the library does exist in some form after that, and it does undergo some decline. And I, you know, second the earlier point about the difficulty of physical evidence and archaeological evidence in Alexandria, because much of the city is under the water and much of the city is under the modern city, much of the ancient one. So it really is very difficult to gather evidence from such a metropolis.
Well, tonight we are exploring the library at Alexandria. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out about its legacy. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the Library of Alexandria. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Professor Vilika Vendrick, who is Research Professor Emerita of Egyptian Archaeology and Digital Humanities at the University of California, Los Angeles, that's UCLA, and also Professor at the Polytechnic University in Turin. Dr. Cynthia Johnston, who lectures on the history of the book at the Institute of English Studies at the School of Advanced Studies at the University of London, and Professor Islam Issa, who's a multi-award-winning author, broadcaster and curator, who's Professor of Literature and History at Birmingham City University and the author of Alexandria, the City That Changed the World. Vilika, when we talk about the destruction of the library and we look at the archaeological evidence, are we able to see evidence of war, of conflict, of turmoil, or is it difficult to separate the different pieces of evidence?
It's extremely difficult to find historical evidence in archaeology, and we have to be very careful not to put interpretations of things we know happened from historical sources on traces that may or may not relate to anything that happened at those particular moments. It is one of the traps of archaeology, actually. So as for Alexandria, we already said at times how extremely difficult it is to get a glimpse of ancient Alexandria, because it's not only that we have Ptolemaic Alexandria, but then we have Roman Alexandria, where the city changed, and then we have medieval Alexandria. And in all those periods, there were changes to the city. So if we look at the structure of the city, there have been attempts to look at the present layout and reconstruct the ancient layout. But through these tiny glimpses, whenever a building needs to be restored or renewed, where there is this little window in ancient Alexandria, it is very clear that the reality is much more complicated than we think. There's certainly not a burning layer or anything of the kind that would point at a huge disaster. It definitely is a slow decline. It has a lot to do with how important the library was thought by the people in charge. We also shouldn't forget that a lot of our knowledge actually was preserved through later Islamic sources, Arabic sources, where there was, again, based still on this value of knowledge that suffused Alexandria, there is a preservation of this ancient knowledge in the Arabic sources. So there's this transition where the value of knowledge is recognized. Alexandria as a place is an idea, it is a myth of knowledge, and that all worked into the preservation of those ancient sources, not in Greek, but in Arabic. Another interesting thing is also how this whole idea then still works in our time. You mentioned the digital knowledge and the digital libraries. The first librarian, allegedly, of the Alexandria Library was Zenodotus. He came from Ephesus, so he wasn't from Egypt. And his name is now used by the data archiving center of CERN in Switzerland, which is called Zenodo. So again, you see that there is this continuation of the importance of knowledge, of the importance of the collections of knowledge, harkening back still to this mythical Library of Alexandria.
And Cynthia, it really is a remarkable legacy that the library it has. It's seen as the first true universal library. It's seen as this significant landmark in the intellectual history of the world, a shining example of what can be achieved in learning and science. It really has a very powerful legacy.
Yes, it does. And you see it coming up again and again in Western literature, certainly, you know, right up to the present day. I suppose Edward Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire makes the loss of Alexandria this huge central tragedy. He makes it a sort of a symbol for sort of barbarity and loss. And he doesn't lay that at the feet of one army or another. He lays it at the feet of someone called Theophilus, who at that time was the archbishopal throne of Alexandria. And he describes him as a man whose hands were alternately polluted with gold and with blood. So it's very dramatic sort of symbol of loss and corruption and a warning in terms of what can happen when that's allowed to happen. And I think that, you know, Gibbon's been disproved, etc. But it's sort of a pervasive myth and a pervasive idea about loss. And even though Gibbon and their successors, in terms of that interpretation, were wrong, the idea, as I said previously, the idea of precarity, the idea of the possibility of catastrophic loss is one that I think that we need to keep on forefront.
And Islam, do you think it's problematic that we do have so many different versions of the destruction from these ancient sources? And, you know, we have the fire of Caesar. We then also have a sack by the Christians. We then have a later destruction of it because of an invasion by Islamic conquerors. That there are these kind of problematic sources about what happened and that tell the story of the destruction in very different ways.
Yes, in many ways, the Library of Alexandria itself, one could argue aspects of ancient Egypt and ancient Greece, actually, seem to have this kind of nonchalant universal ownership where we all feel a little bit Alexandrian. We all relate to the idea and understand the idea of gathering knowledge, of taking care of knowledge, of looking up to the learned, of being upset when knowledge is destroyed or denied. So I think that kind of universal ownership of the idea, of the story, of the concept does exist. And in turn, it can be used for different means, to different ends. There are those who will find a nice moral in the story of Alexandria, which is, you know, that you can that knowledge is important, that we can have ambition of sort of gathering knowledge, and there are those who might see the perils of that, the perils of overambition, the perils of total knowledge, and the dangers that can, the double-edged sword that can provide in terms of power. And we see that double-edged sword with the internet today. And of course, you know, using that to political ends is something that, that constantly happens. And it's much less exciting to say, well, actually, there were attacks by Caracalla and Aurelian in the 3rd century, you know, who were Roman rulers, and then the rise of Christianity, there was some book burning. But then we also have Orosius, who's a Roman historian in the 5th century, who goes to the library and says, the shelves are empty, and so on. And sometimes it doesn't meet a political agenda to say, well, actually, the Fatimids really did restore much of the Alexandrian knowledge, as has been mentioned, in Baghdad when they translated lots of the Greek texts that would otherwise have been lost.
And Islam, do you think it deserves to be celebrated and remembered today because it did help change human history because of what it did in terms of collecting human knowledge? Or is it more important in terms of the symbolism of what it represents in terms of the idea of preserving human knowledge and collecting it?
I think the change that it symbolizes is important. This idea that you can be ambitious with knowledge, that you can integrate through knowledge, that you can collate and emend the classics. I think that's really important as well, that you can create a hierarchy of knowledge in a useful way. You know, they have the main orators and they respected certain poets. So I think Alexandrian scholarship, through its collation and emendation of the classics, through attempting to invent new technologies that transform civilization into a new age of modernity, and perhaps most importantly, the fact that the whole project asked and sought to answer some of the biggest questions about humanity, about what it means to be human. And so for me, the importance is that it's a precursor to many of the daring movements that come after it. So that's the European Renaissance that asked these big questions, the Enlightenment, the Islamic Golden Age, and the many industrial revolutions.
Well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Vilika Vendrick, Research Professor Emerita of Egyptian Archaeology and Digital Humanities at UCLA, and also Professor at the Polytechnic University in Turin, Dr. Cynthia Johnston of the Institute of English Studies at the University of London, and Professor Islam Issa, Professor of Literature and History at Birmingham City University, and the author of Alexandria, the City That Changed the World. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, to Hannah Flam, and to Peter Malloy. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.